doing it this late in the year is pretty unusual and is an indication that the ice is pretty thin.
A record-setting transit of the Northern Sea Route. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska school districts consider policies to accommodate transgender students.
Something that we've never had to deal with before, and we're barely able to keep two bathrooms open, much less develop a third one.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker has withdrawn his re-election bid. In a statement, Hawker said he wants to make the most of his miraculous response to cancer treatment and the renewed life God has given him. He said he wants to devote more time to studying for ordination as a Roman Catholic deacon and to work on health care reform. Hawker was first elected to the State House in 2002. Aide Julie Lucky said by email that he plans to serve out his current term. Hawker is known for his policy work, including his involvement in legislation setting up the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, but he also has endured criticism over the cost of a lease for Anchorage legislative office space that he helped negotiate. According to the Russian media outlet Port News, a Russian icebreaker just completed the fastest transit of the Northern Sea Route. Along with setting the speed record at 7.5 days, the icebreaker also completed the trip over a month after the shipping season usually ends in the Arctic. But as KNOM's Emily Russell reports, it's still a long ways off from becoming the next great trade route.
Statistics from the past few years do show a handful of other transits taking less than 8 days, so it's not exactly the speed that's most impressive, but the time of year the trip took place. According to statistics from the Northern Sea Route Information Office, the last three shipping seasons wrapped up in mid-November. The Vyash started its trip in mid-December, completing the record-breaking journey on Christmas Day. Walt Meyer, a research scientist for NASA and co-author of NOAA's 2015 Arctic Report Card on Sea Ice, says the successful transit is a sign of changing ice conditions in the Arctic.
Doing it this late in the year is pretty unusual and is an indication that the ice is pretty thin. You know, they have confidence they can get through without too much trouble.
That confidence was showcased at an international Arctic forum in St. Petersburg in early December, where Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin said the Northern Sea Route could soon be operational year-round. But despite the record transit and proclaimed potential of the route, Andreas Ostagen, a senior fellow at the Arctic Institute, doesn't think this is the start of an Arctic boom.
I'm assuming that what they are doing, and I say they, I mean the Russian authorities, is just highlighting the capabilities they have.
Those capabilities include the largest fleet of icebreakers in the world, with more than Norway, Canada, Denmark, and the U.S. combined. While Russia's unmatched fleet allows them to offer more escorts and assistance along their Arctic coastline, it hasn't exactly attracted more international traffic. The number of vessels that traveled the full length of the route dropped from more than 70 in 2013 to less than 20 in 2015. The amount of cargo transported dropped even more dramatically by about 97% in just 2 years. So what can explain all of this? Ostagen says, among other factors, the recent plunge in oil prices means the shorter route is just less attractive to international traffic.
And then you had the incidents in Ukraine in 2014, naturally hampering some sort of the operational environment, maybe not directly, but at least indirectly, the business climate for Russian collaboration in the Northern Sea Route was damaged to some extent.
Despite persisting political tensions, there is one type of traffic that has been on the rise, destinational traffic, or intra-transits, as Ostagen describes them.
When you look at the numbers for this year, for the Northern Sea Route, I think it's quite obvious that what is taking place in the Northern Sea Route is intra-transits, transits with a destination in the Northern Sea Route in itself.
Russia granted over 700 permits for vessels traveling along the route, a number that has steadily risen over the past few years. The amount of cargo is also up, nearly doubling between 2013 and 2015. So what's next for the Northern Sea Route? While it's hard to predict how the political climate may shift, NASA's Meyer says the changing climate in the Arctic is leading to thinner ice.
And as the ice is thinner, it's more easily blown by the winds as well, so it can more easily kind of move away from the coast.
With any luck and the right winds, the Northern Sea Route will be back open for business in June of next year. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Fairbanks' first marijuana business has been open for just over a month. The Higher Calling is one of several so-called clubs in the state that have arisen since voters' passage of a marijuana legalization initiative in 2014. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, clubs like Fairbanks' The Higher Calling do not sell marijuana.
The Higher Calling, or THC, co-owner Megan Moores describes her downtown area business as a private club for cannabis enthusiasts.
Membership allows you use of the building to bring your own cannabis products to use or smoke.
Moore says the club, which offers coffee, snacks, and a game room, signed up 130 paying members in its first month of operation. Moore's husband and business partner, Marcus Moore, says the club does not allow synthetic marijuana or alcohol on premises and is being very careful about how the operation is run.
We recognize that we are the flagship cannabis business for all of the North Star Borough. So while we're doing a lot to try to make our members happy and to help the community realize that it's okay for them to, it's legal now, it's okay to come out and consume and even say that you smoke marijuana or consume marijuana, we also want to make sure that we're really respectful to the community and the neighborhood.
Moore says that includes measures taken in light of the club's proximity to a daycare facility.
We've kept our signage to a minimum. We tailored our hours to sort of be alternate to the daycare there. We are, out of respect for the community, trying to, look around and see what other options we have to possibly move the club to a different location.
Marijuana clubs are not currently covered by local or state regulations, which are focused on commercial marijuana cultivation, processing, testing, and retail sale. Megan Moore says they are ready to comply if things change.
There's debate on whether they'll be licensing for private clubs. If so, then we'll be applying for a license for that.
Alaska Marijuana Control Board Executive Director Cindy Franklin says the panel recognizes the need for public places to consume marijuana, but considers clubs operating in their current unlicensed, unregulated form illegal, adding that the state board has yet to address the issue. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new Bible translated into Yupik.
In my experience, the new orthography is much easier to use and learn.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The UAS School of Management offers Bachelor of Business Administration degree programs online with an emphasis in human resources and management information systems. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
A state health department official says that since the state expanded Medicaid to cover more lower-income Alaskans on September 1st, about 7,700 people have enrolled. Chris Ashenbrenner is the Medicaid program coordinator for the state health department. The department has estimated that nearly 20,100 newly eligible Alaskans would enroll during the first year of expansion, and Ashenbrenner believes enrollment is on track for that. She says enrollment in the first half of the year may be more robust because of pent-up demand for health care. She says open enrollment periods through the federally facilitated health insurance marketplace also bring in a lot of new Medicaid applications, because the system can make a Medicaid eligibility determination or refer cases to the state for a determination. school bathrooms and locker rooms have become legal battlegrounds recently as courts in the lower 48 puzzle over how schools should treat students who don't identify with the gender they were assigned at birth. Now, two statewide education organizations are trying to equip Alaska school districts with policies regarding transgender students. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports.
Gender identity and sexual orientation. Those are the four words that school boards across the state are being advised to add to their non-discrimination policies. The language is coming from the Alaska Association of School Boards, a nonprofit organization with the membership of over 50 school districts. AASB Director of Policy Services Bob Wicker says, though each school district adopts its own policy,
usually they need guidance. They need guidance from around the nation and through also the legal means, because a lot of these policies have developed through court cases or challenges.
Wicker says several court cases to do with transgender students have been brewing in the lower 48 recently. In October, the U.S. Justice Department supported a Virginia student who sued for access to the boys' restroom at his high school. The Obama administration said the issue falls under Title IX, a federal law that bans sex discrimination. In another case, the U.S. Department of Education told an Illinois district that it violated a transgender student's rights when it required the student to use separate changing and showering facilities. Wicker says AASB is trying to prevent such legal battles in Alaska.
The legal team here that AASB uses, they go and glean this information from these different court cases that are out and about. And so they thought that we could help school districts by putting within the non-discrimination board policy gender identity and sexual orientation.
The Southwest Region School Board looked at the new policy at a meeting this month. They had unanimously passed the new language in a previous meeting, but after looking at the regulations that come along with it, Board President Kay Andrews said the members were hesitant about what looks like another unfunded mandate.
Something that we've never had to deal with before, and we're barely able to keep two bathrooms open, much less develop a third one. So that's concerning.
The Southwest Region School Board decided to table that policy until they can get legal counsel on what it might mean in practice. Meanwhile, the Alaska School Activities Association, that's the regulating body for interscholastic sports and other activities, is also grappling with rules on gender identity. Executive Director Billy Strickland says ASAA is updating a bylaw about contact sports that are separated by boys and girls teams.
We are contemplating adding language that would say the association, that would be ASAA, will rely on the gender determination made by the student's member school using an objective process. So the gist of that is we feel like member schools have to have an objective process for making gender determinations, but once they do so, that student may participate on the gender that their member school has deemed appropriate for them.
What that objective process for gender determination looks like will have to be fleshed out by each district. But Strickland says it should have to do with making sure a student has consistently identified with a gender over a period of time.
It's not that a student just suddenly declares, I am a boy or I am a girl. You know, I think there's a certain amount of background that is followed through, statements from the family, friends of the family, potentially psychologists. We don't anticipate every district's policy looking the same, but those would be some of the processes.
It's a controversial change, which Strickland expects will see some pushback. But he says the policy change will not only help protect schools from lawsuits, it also supports ASAA's mission to encourage student participation in activities.
So the student that is currently uncomfortable participating based on their gender identity, ultimately we feel like we also want that student being able to benefit from what extracurricular participation does for kids. And so, you know, I don't think that we won't have some people thinking this is the wrong idea, but we believe it is a step in helping our member schools deal with difficult decisions and part of what we do.
Several districts in the state, notably Anchorage and the Fairbanks North Starborough school districts, have included gender identity in their non-discrimination policies for several years now. Reporting in Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
As state lawmakers prepare to grapple with a tight state budget, one nonprofit is gearing up to deal with health needs in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The Matsu Health Foundation is stepping in to provide funding for behavioral health services in the face of expected cuts. As KSK's Ellen Lockyer reports, one program benefiting from grant money is aiming to curb drug and alcohol abuse with a focus on childhood trauma.
Recent reports of legislators eyeing further cuts to education and social services has alarmed health providers in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. As it is, the Matsu Health Foundation is trying to fill the gap in state funding with a series of grants aimed at helping health providers expand needed services for a growing population. Robin Menard is the Health Foundation's Public Affairs Director.
There is some state funding, but unfortunately, our state funding per capita is significantly less than other areas of the state. Our dollars haven't changed, even though our population has doubled.
Menard says the current amount of state funding available for Matsu is like operating with $1,990 dollars in 2015. And that money is not distributed fairly, she says, as she points to a graphic comparing what state grants pay Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau per person for youth and adult mental health care and for substance abuse services. For instance, Matsu gets $13 per person for substance abuse. Juneau gets $44. Despite an escalating need for them, detox beds don't exist in Matsu, and long-term recovery centers are in short supply there, Menard says. She says two Health Foundation reports assessing borough health needs point to substance abuse as the number one health care target in the area.
And then we're also trying to look at, well, what causes people to become addicts in the first place? And a lot of times that's traced back to childhood trauma. There's a reason people are abusing drugs and alcohol.
Earlier this month, the Health Foundation awarded $1.7 million in healthy impact grants, and one of the recipients is CCS Early Learning, the Head Start provider in Chugiak and the Valley. CCS Executive Director Mark Lackey says the organization serves some 320 students under age 5, the majority from low-income homes.
I think we've always been very aware of the fact that a lot of our kids have trauma and that trauma impacts their lives, you know, over the long term.
Early exposure to domestic violence or drug use or alcohol abuse are some of those traumas. Lackey says the CDC's Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACEs, focused attention on childhood trauma's lingering impacts. And ACEs information is prompting changes in how teachers and caregivers relate to their students, however young. CCS is using the grant to build its Road to Resilience program for parents and staff.
With this grant that we received from the Matsu Health Foundation, we are really working hard to educate our parents about the ACEs study. You know, even our own staff found that just thinking about ACEs in a different way changes how you really, you know, relate to children. It's no longer necessarily about the child, it's about why that child is having those behaviors.
But early childhood trauma is not a life sentence, Lackey says, and it can be overcome. CCS's resilience program started introducing parents to ACEs last year. This year, the money will be used to further train staff and to increase mental health assessment capabilities. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Increase the earning power with a Bachelor of Business Administration degree with a Human Resource Management emphasis from the UAS School of Management. Details at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The Bible is now available in modern Yupik after nearly half a century of work put in by fluent Yupik speakers in the Bethel region and the American Bible Society. KYUK's Charles Enoch spoke to elders who were involved with the project.
Psalms 119, verse 105. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path.
The
That was Bethel Elder Elsie Jimmy, or Ingi Chakinupik. For the past 6 years, she was part of the team that completed the conversion of the Holy Bible, or Tangkilrit Igat, into the newer and much easier to read Yupik orthography that was developed by linguist Stephen Jacobson in the 1980s. Jacobson's Yupik textbooks and dictionaries are in use in the Lower Kuskokwim School District schools that teach the Yupik language to their students. That was a primary motivator for the elders, says Moravian pastor Jones Anover of Guigilnguk.
We wanted the youngest of our generation to be able to read and fully appreciate the Holy Bible.
Anover says the first missionaries translated just the New Testament into an early form of Yupik writing that had no guidelines other than how it would sound using English writing rules, and they never translated the Old Testament, so the team translated the Old Testament into Yupik based off of the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, and they rewrote the New Testament using modern Yupik orthography. Jimmy says the early translations took more learning to read.
My father taught me to read the Bible's early Yupik translations after I learned English. In my experience, the new orthography is much easier to use and learn.
Jimmy also says before the new Bible was available, when going to church events in other villages, she used to bring an English Bible along with her Yupik one for reference in case she had trouble understanding the old one, which was often the case for those who relied on the first translations. According to a letter to the Delta Discovery by the late Reverend Peter Green, who passed away earlier this year, the project started in 1971 with Pastors Teddy Brink and Peter Andrews under the guidance of the American Bible Society. The American Bible Society did not respond to inquiries at the time the story was written. Jimmy says some elders who participated passed away, leaving their work unfinished.
When people pass away, we would keep their translations and others would rise to continue the work. Most recently, Peter Green, Jones Anover, Jacob Nelson, and myself made the last push to finish the project.
Green and Nelson passed away this year. Jimmy says wherever they are, they and many others who helped can now rest assured with their goals achieved.
An elderly man who couldn't read or write called me sometime after the project was completed. He was very happy the Bible was converted into the modern Yupik style because his grandchildren now fluently read and teach the Old Testament to him.
The new Yupik Bible was celebrated at the Bethel Moravian Church last October, and it is sold at the Moravian Bookstore in Bethel. KYUK contacted the Bethel Moravian Church for information, but they declined to interview. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Former Juneau Mayor Jamie Parsons died Saturday in Washington State after more than a decade battling cancer. He was 74. Friends and former colleagues remember his sense of humor, his love of sports, and his unfailing commitment to the capital city. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Jamie Parsons moved to Juneau in 1972 to become the city's first Parks and Recreation Director. He served on the Juneau Assembly for most of the 1980s and became mayor in 1991.
I consider him a dear friend. You know, he was a tireless promoter of Juneau, and he's going to be deeply missed by this community.
Juneau Senator Dennis Egan served as Parsons' deputy mayor.
One year we went to the gold medal tournament. Albert Kukesh and Jamie and I are in a free throw contest. I can't shoot a free throw. And here we were in front of all these fans. And of course I missed.
But Parsons said Egan could have Kukesh's points.
And Kukesh could have mine, so I won.
Egan says Parsons was nonpartisan and got along with all the assembly members.
I don't care who you were, he'd sit down and talk to you. A lot of that's missed right now. I didn't know if he was a Republican or Democrat. We never talked politics. We talked about Juneau and making Juneau better.
Paulette Simpson was another close friend and worked on Parsons' mayoral campaign in 1991.
Jamie excelled at friendship. And he understood that, especially in politics, friendship was foundational if you were going to be successful.
Simpson says if there was a legislator who spoke against Juneau being the capital city,
Jamie's reaction to that was to go make friends with the person and invite them to dinner. And he and Mary Beth were absolutely the most gracious, hospitable leaders we probably ever had. And I think that went really far with people. Because he excelled at friendship, he put that to work for the capital city.
After one term as mayor, instead of running for re-election, Parsons put his energy toward fighting a 1994 ballot initiative to move the capital to Wasilla. Parsons traveled throughout Southeast to encourage voter turnout and traveled north as well. Longtime legislative aide Christopher Clark was working in Anchorage as the field coordinator in the campaign against the measure. He says Parsons was key to defeating it.
He helped organize it. He'd go out door to door. He'd give speeches. He'd talk to editorial board meetings. He'd go to newspapers, interviews, and it all worked. Jamie was with me in Anchorage on the night of the election returns, and we were jubilant. We once again had dodged a bullet and managed to keep the Capitol here in Juneau, and Jamie deserves a lot of the credit for that.
Like Parsons, close friend Wynne Greening also served as chair of the Alaska Committee. He says Parsons helped Juneau become an even better capital city by making it more accessible. It was his idea to do C-SPAN coverage of the Alaska legislature, what's now known as Gavel, Alaska.
He bridged a lot of gaps. He listened to people, and he always tried to figure out a way to get people to some sort of an agreement so that they could move forward on things.
Parsons also owned the Juneau Racquet Club with John McConaughey for about 20 years. McConaughey now co-owns Cycle Alaska with his wife. He calls Parsons a mentor who taught him the concept of paying your civic rent.
Where business people in town have an obligation to give back to the community that's being supportive of them. And he certainly exemplified that throughout his whole life.
McConaughey and Parsons were also very close friends. While traveling in New Zealand, McConaughey spoke with him days before he died.
What was amazing about that is Jamie was so positive and great energy. Even though he was on some pain medication, that spark was still there.
Parsons also once served as CEO of the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. In a letter to chamber members about Parsons' death, Executive Director Craig Dahl called him an inspiration and wrote, "Juneau has never had a more committed advocate." In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Russell in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, Charles Enoch in Bethel, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. And Monica Goki is also our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Alaska Pacific University delivers an affordable education and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2016 and find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.